WDIY News is pleased to welcome back Dr. Jeffrey Jerry for a Lehigh Valley coronavirus update. He is the Senior Vice President of Medical and Academic Affairs and Chief Emeritus of Infectious Disease Specialists with St. Luke's University Health Network. Welcome, Doctor.
Well, thank you very much for having me again. It's always a pleasure to be with you, and I trust that you and your audience are well.
With the local to regional new case levels, we've seen stories nationally suggesting that case rates are down. What can you speak about the Lehigh Valley?
The good news is that certainly around the country, the case rates are down by as much as 70% from where they were just in the beginning of January. And we have certainly seen that in the state of Pennsylvania and to a large degree locally as well. It's absolutely the truth in terms of hospital cases. And that's all very, very good news because this drop has relieved a lot of the pressure that many of us have been experiencing. On the other hand, it's also well to know that this pandemic is still very much with us. And in fact, if you take a look at the Lehigh Valley per se, and I'm talking about Northampton County and Lehigh County in particular, it is among the highest case rate still on a daily basis per population within our state. So we know that it is not something that we can say is a done deed, and we have to be particularly on guard. There are certain reasons why it might be very high, particularly in Northampton County. We know that Lehigh University has been experiencing a major outbreak. They're responsible for something like 600 cases all told, and that is reflected in the overall numbers for the county. On the other hand, there are certainly many other reasons why both of these counties still have issues. We have a lot of nursing homes, and we have populations that still are not totally adhering to all the things that we know you can do in order to help staunch the spread of this disease.
Governor Wolf announced through a press release that at least 600 long-term or senior care facilities have been vaccinated with over 315,000 shots. Is that what you're hearing as well?
There's definitely been progress, and I don't want to underestimate the progress that has been made. But we also have to say that with that progress, there's also a large population that hasn't been able to benefit from that. And that's even true in some of our nursing home populations. Unfortunately, the nursing home vaccination was assigned to some of the larger pharmaceutical chains. And up until very recently, they have not been able to accommodate the chains or the amount of recipients that they need to. And we've actually had to step in some cases locally to help bail out some of the nursing homes that were very late in receiving their vaccines.
Just as there, and I don't want to over-exaggerate, but just as there is a light on the horizon, there's much information in the news about variants. And there are reports of at least 7 variants of the COVID-19 virus in the United States, some of them from the United Kingdom, South Africa, and Brazil, even others that are homegrown. What can you share with our listeners about any immediate dangers or future possibilities?
Well, you're quite correct that the two big issues that we're facing right now as a country are vaccine supply and rollout, and the second is the emergence and potential emergence of these variants or mutants. So I think it is probably worthwhile going into a little bit of detail on where we stand in terms of specifically the variant strains. Number one, as we've said before, all viruses mutate, and they mutate constantly, and seeing literally hundreds or thousands of mutations is not unusual. The good news is that the vast, vast majority of these mutations are not consequential. However, when you have a large population of virus, and we know that worldwide that there's more than 100 million people that have been affected by the COVID-19 virus, that even if it is a very small percentage that end up with these variants, you're going to end up with reasonably high numbers simply because of the large population that you're dealing with. And we also know that that exists in the United States. And with the constant flow of people back and forth where you can be in any place in the world in less than 24 hours, it's very, very easy to spread these variants. So what is the current situation? The current situation is that there are 3 major variants that we are particularly concerned about that have already made inroads. The first one, and the one that's most predominant, is the variant that's found in the United Kingdom, or the so-called B.1.1.7 variant. That has become the predominant strain in a fairly short period of time in the United Kingdom. We know that that is the predominant variant that already exists in the United States, and certainly we have found it in Pennsylvania as well. What's the problem? The problem is that that variant has certain properties that seem to make it at least 50% more likely to be infectious. In other words, you have higher quantities of virus in your nose and it makes it much more easily spread. And the second is that it appears that it might be as much as 50% more virulent in that it can cause much more severe disease. And we're also seeing that kind of effect in a younger population than what was affected with the original wild virus. There are predictions, because of the rapid rate that this is spreading in the United Kingdom, that this will happen here and will become one of our predominant strains by the end of March. So with all of the good news that we just stated in terms of dropping of cases, there's a major fear that this can reverse this. Is that going to happen? Well, of course, we don't know. Should we at least be cognizant of that possibility? The answer to that is absolutely. And that is a major reason why getting out a large supply of vaccine into people's arms is very important. Because the one good thing at this point in time is that the vaccines that we have available so far, and as you know, it's the Pfizer and Moderna vaccine, still seem to be very, very active against this type of variant. And because of that, if we can actually reduce that population, we're going to reduce the spread, we're going to reduce its potential virulence, and all of the bad things that go along with it. The other two strains or variants that are out there is a South African variant, as well as another one, which is a Brazilian. And then there is a number of what we would call homegrown variants, some of which are more common in California. Again, I think the important thing is that there's less of those around at this point in time than the United Kingdom variant. It is not clear that they have the same simple transmission or an easier transmission than the wild type. And certainly there is not good evidence at this point in time that they're more virulent. But they all have that capacity that they can transform themselves into a much worse strain. And that's the thing that we have to be aware of. So we don't want to give it that opportunity to do so. And we can talk about how these affect certain types of aspects of the virus, such as the spike protein, which actually acts as an attachment vehicle for the virus as it gets into our body and then reproduces, that it can change that and it can make it easier to kind of grasp on into our body and then reproduce. We don't want to give it that opportunity. We don't want to give it an opportunity to develop resistance to the vaccines. So the quicker we get out these vaccines, the more of a population that we have that is resistant to these variants, the better off we're going to be.
For a lack of visual, could you suggest a petri dish-like comparison?
Yeah, I think you certainly can. And just another way of looking at it is this, that all organisms are going to try and survive. That is the basic aspect of evolution, and certainly it applies to every organism, including humans, that we adapt to our circumstances. And viruses actually can do that quite well. So the more pressure that you put on viruses to halt their transmission, you're going to have a few that are going to try and develop escape mechanisms.
Possibly successfully, obviously, with the variants that we're dealing with. One weapon or one tool in fighting the variants is sequencing them and the United States response. There has been reports that suggest there is a lacking of response in the United States, slow to do so as far as sequencing not only the California variant, but again, other variants coming into our country. What is the importance of sequencing to eradicate COVID-19, gaining control of the virus?
You need to know how much of a problem that you're facing in order to be able to combat it in the most logical way and in the most effective way. So at this point in time, I think we have an estimate of the effect that these variants might be having, but we don't have a good numerical calculator that tells us in a more exact fashion. So we are behind in sequencing. There has been a rapid catch-up in order to try and make up for that, and I think it's being done in a successful manner. I can tell you at St. Luke's, one of the advantages that we have is that we are now employing a type of testing that can identify potential variants, and then we send that off to the state, and then the state can actually do the more sophisticated testing along with with the CDC to see whether it actually is in fact a variant, and it looks very, very promising. So all of these things, I think, are going to helpful, because you have to know what kind of a problem you have in order to know the best way to face against it.
Should residents presume the more contractible variants are already here in the Valley?
Not only can you presume it, we know that for a fact.
Can you describe what viral shedding is?
Absolutely. One of the major questions that has always been thrown about is that if you are vaccinated, we know that vaccine will prevent the major forms of disease, but it doesn't necessarily prevent infection. So that you could have a subclinical infection where you're not developing the symptoms, but you still have the virus replicating in you, and then that virus is being shed. And when that virus is shed, it obviously can be transmitted to others. So the real question is, if you get the vaccine, are you reducing that amount of viral shedding? We didn't have an answer. Quite frankly, now I think we can say that we pretty much do. There are two studies. They're preliminary, but I think there's very, very good evidence involved with both of them. One is out of Israel, the other is out of the United Kingdom, and they're starting to be replicated here in the United States, that shows people who are vaccinated will actually have far, far less shedding and therefore less transmissibility. All of that is great news. So what you want is you want to get that vaccine, you want to get the full doses of the vaccine in effect so that you have less virus that you're shedding and that you're in less danger to anyone else. It also is known that one of the things, if you get the natural infection, that most of us can produce a very, very good immune response. And when you produce that immune response, that the amount of viral shedding goes down precipitously. We also can assume that if you have a problem with your immune system, that your viral shedding may be much more prolonged because your response is not as vigorous. So all of these things have to be taken into account when we come out with quarantine rules for people, etc.
How does this concept compare to the term vaccine escape?
Vaccine escape refers to the fact that I had mentioned earlier that if you give less of a dose of vaccine that actually knocks the virus off, that you allow certain virus particles to escape that can then be resistant to that vaccine or develop resistance. So let's put it into a real life component. One of the things that has come out very recently is that we know that the Pfizer vaccine and the Moderna vaccine are two dose vaccines. And there is some evidence that if you give one dose, that could be, quote, effective. The problem with that is that evidence shows that it could be very effective for 15 to 28 days. It doesn't tell you what long-term effects are likely to be, and we know that there's a fall-off. When you have a fall-off in the kind of antibody that's produced by the vaccine, then what you're doing is giving a suboptimal dose to the virus that you have, and allows many more of those individual viruses to escape and then develop true resistance to it. So in a real sense right now, what I want to caution everyone who's out there who's gotten either the Pfizer vaccine or the Moderna vaccine is to please, please get that second dose. That second dose as of right now is felt to be essential in order to give you the long-term immunity that you're going to need and to prevent a more resistant virus from escaping out into the atmosphere.
And of course, with more vaccinations, but also with more people contracting and hopefully getting over the disease, we're all trying to, as a goal, reach herd immunity.
Yeah, because one of the things when you talk about, by the way, escaping, that can happen with natural immunity as well. So, you know, the more people that are immune out there, the less likely you are to have these kinds of strains that are going to get out there that are going to be much more dangerous. Now, in terms of herd immunity, we know that the virus has to survive for all practical purposes in humans. That's where it primarily replicates. So if you have a large number of people where that virus can't replicate, then it's likely to come to a stop, or at least to be at such a low level that it won't pose a threat. So the real question is, how much of a level do you need out in your population in order to establish that kind of protection that we would say then is community protection? And the numbers that have been thrown about are generally somewhere between 75 and 85%.
Thank you, Dr. Jeffrey Jerry of St. Luke's University Health Network. We appreciate your time and expert information.
I hope that was helpful. It's always a pleasure, James. And I hope that you, your family, and your colleagues are staying safe and healthy.
Join Dr. Jerry tomorrow during All Things Considered at 5:44 for part two of this COVID-19 update, where we'll review the Pennsylvania vaccine rollout, its process, and questions surrounding it. For WDIY News, James Johnson reporting.